This week, we've got an all-new Masonic Mythbusters with worshipful brother Patrick Day, the history, the drama, the gossip about Oscar Wilde and his connection to Freemasonry. Once a brother, expelled, even imprisoned, and still considered a brother? Join us as Patrick takes us through all the facts and even decodes what the crimes then mean today. Then we will dive right back into part 5 of our 6-part series on Manly P. Hall's Occult Anatomy of Man. We'll read about occult embryology, are the stages of man's birth related to various archetypes within the spiritual and physical world? Are the stories of gods and goddesses directly correspond to the development of man? We'll find out all this and more. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back. This is episode number 602. I want to thank our contributors, fellows, producers, and legacy partners of the WCY podcast. Whether you have assisted us through Patreon or through PayPal, your monthly contributions to this program all go right back into the creation of it and help to ensure that quality, trusted Masonic education is available for any brothers out there or anyone interested in Freemasonry or its kindred sciences. If you're curious on how you can help support the WCY podcast in this way, head on over to WCYpodcast.com, click on Support the Show, and check out the various options. Additionally, we have a shop, we have the bookstore, which has an extensive list of books, which are wonderful and have been mentioned on the show, or perhaps are my own personal recommended reading lists that are through Amazon affiliate. It's a win-win, so the authors get a sale, the show gets a couple pennies, and you get a great book. All of those are available, and again, all money raised goes right back into the production of this show, including a substantial portion of all orders made through Skull and Crown Limited, and personal tarot card readings by yours truly for you. Now, before we get into the meat of this week's episode, which is our continuing series on Manly P. Hall's Occult Anatomy of Man, where we get into Part 5, Occult Embryology, we are going to have a very special episode of Masonic Mythbusters with worshipful brother Patrick Day. I have always maintained that if there is going to be some sort of content on the show which may be sensitive to listeners, that I would always warn you. And I will tell you that this week's Masonic Mythbusters is one such piece. The piece lasts about 16 minutes and 30 seconds from start to finish. So I just want to let you know in case you would like to fast forward a bit. So we're going to get into that right now.
In a digital landscape filled with historical inaccuracy, out-of-context quotes on memes and soundbites, there is an epidemic of fraternal occult, mythological, and historical misinformation. It's time to set the record straight. Masonic Mythbusters with Patrick Day.
Ever bring up Oscar Wilde to another Mason, and then they cut you off and emphasize, Brother Oscar Wilde? They love to do this. I mean, we are proud to be Masons and proud of the fraternity, and therefore proud of famous Masons. And Oscar Wilde is a world-renowned writer and poet. And he was a Freemason at one time. Was. That's the key word there. Was. His father was a Mason. His close friend, Prince Leopold, the sixth son of Queen Victoria, was also a Freemason, as was his friend John Colton A. Baldley. Both of them may have been the impetus for Wilde's interest in Freemasonry. Wilde would petition Apollo University Lodge number 357 while attending Magdalen College at Oxford. He was initiated on February 23rd, 1875, passed to the degree of Fellowcraft on April 24th, and raised on May 25th. He would go on to receive the 18th degree of the Scottish Rite at Oxford University Chapter Rose Croix, number 40, on November 27th, 1876, That same year, he would affiliate with Churchill Lodge, number 478, and the following year was appointed junior deacon. On March 22nd, 1878, he received the Mark Master degree. But let me ask this. Would you call someone who was suspended or expelled from the fraternity a brother? Or, to be more jurisprudent, does Masonic law entitle one who has been suspended or expelled to carry the title of brother or Mason? No. It is nearly universal across all jurisdictions that a Mason must be in good standing to be entitled to the right to be called a Mason. In 1878, Oscar Wilde was expelled from Apollo University Lodge for non-payment of dues. And the same again in 1883 from Churchill Lodge. And let me be clear, the minutes of Churchill Lodge records that Wilde was expelled for, quote, having failed to acknowledge the three communications forwarded to him, end quote. Thus, his Masonic career ended, though it had ended long before that. He graduated from Magdalen College in 1878. He would return to Dublin for a brief period, then he moved to London. And in 1881, he got married. So just like Mark Twain, once his career was taking off and he got married, he really didn't have much interest in Freemasonry. Now, let me add some of my own commentary. Oscar Wilde was a dandy, which was sometimes called a fop. This is someone who was overly concerned with their appearance, oftentimes wearing lavishly stylish and fashionable clothes and attire. He was a perfect expression of consumption and waste in the sense of like George Bataille's notions of expenditure. He overspent continuously and repeatedly and was even held in university court for failure to pay outstanding debts. We probably should not see his involvement in Freemasonry as a passion for the fraternity or to associate within a society of good morals. No, he was probably more interested in wearing fancy clothes and regalia, which he did when he attended Lodge. Also probably more interested in elaborate rituals and be part of high society than really anything Freemasonry offered on a moral level. And joining a second lodge, the Scottish Rite, and a Mark Master's Lodge, that was probably just him overspending. Now, type into a Google search the words Oscar Wilde Freemason, and you will get a lot of results. Masons love to write about Freemasons who were famous. Nearly all the links you will find seem to omit one very important detail about Oscar Wilde's career, and his literary career for that matter. Namely, he was a homosexual, or at the least bisexual, and was brought up on criminal charges for... Oh, yeah, I should probably just go ahead and give a content warning here. If you are uncomfortable or triggered by discussions on homosexuality for whatever reason, or unlawful sexual activities, particularly illicit sexual activity upon a minor, then you might just want to skip over all of this, because these were things Oscar Wilde was charged with and found guilty of. So we're going to be talking about them. Starting in 1886, Oscar Wilde would begin to engage in homosexual activities with a number of men. That year, he would meet Robert Ross. Ross was, quote, an unrestrained homosexual. And Ross was infatuated with Oscar Wilde's poetry. And some have argued that Ross was the one who seduced Oscar Wilde. Mind you, Oscar Wilde was 32 and Ross was 17. Big age difference there. In 1891, Wilde began to be regularly involved in an affair with Lord Alfred Douglas, who was 21, and Wilde was 37. Again, big age difference there. Lord Douglas was a handsome young dandy, like Oscar Wilde. Lord Douglas would introduce Wilde to England's underground homosexual prostitution scene in 1892. This scene was filled with young male prostitutes. You can't see me doing air quotes around the word prostitute, but I am, because many of these male sex workers were young boys, like 13 to 18 years old. Though certainly, There were many who were much older, but some assess that most of these boys were around 16. They were frequently driven to do sex work due to poverty, and sex work was basically their only means to not starve to death, and being young and attractive, it was quite lucrative for them. Certain upper-class and upper-middling-class men took advantage of such unfortunates. These boys were frequently called rent boys. Yep, and Oscar Wilde just loved this scene. He would buy the boys, he frequented lavish gifts, he would privately dine with them, etc. One boy in particular caught Wilde's fancy, a boy named Alfred Taylor, who was believed to be about 16 years old at the time their relationship began. These boys were different from Wilde's other homosexual relationships with Lord Douglas, Robert Ross, and possibly John Gray, who some have argued was the inspiration for Dorian Gray, but such has been denied, and there's as much evidence against as for such association between Dorian Gray and John Gray. These boys were not literate. They understood little to nothing of Wilde's fine sense of aesthetics, fashion, and prose, and this was the issue. In Victorian society, there was nothing wrong with being gay or having homosexual affairs, as long as it was relatively discreet and you eventually got married. Even women were encouraged to have a best friend and to have a sexual relationship with them. Yeah, it was encouraged. Just get married to a man eventually and do whatever you want. And of course, one should not be bringing their homosexual or heterosexual lover to formal events. That should be reserved for your spouse. And, you know, don't flaunt your affair publicly or engage in public displays of affection. Overall, homosexuality was relatively tolerated in Victorian society. However, there were a few big rules, and two of the most important were ones that Wilde would violate. Firstly, no sexual affairs with youths, and no affairs with those below your social class. In both instances, these were observed because adults hold power over the youth, and the upper classes hold power over the impoverished. Further, adults having sex with minors was deemed corrupting to the youth and thus forbidden. Socrates was executed for corrupting the youth, and Oscar Wilde's reputation would be ruined for it. Then Wilde got caught. In 1895, the Marquess of Queensberry, John Sholto Douglas, who was Lord Alfred Douglas's father, would accuse Wilde thusly, quote, "For Oscar Wilde, posing as a sodomite." It's supposed to say sodomite, but the cursive looks like sodomite. I guess Victorians took liberties in reading cursive. Anyway. The Marquess had repeatedly instructed his son to cut off his relationship with Oscar Wilde, threatening to cut him off financially, which was repeatedly ignored. Now, the Marquess was a domineering man, as was well known, and finding this unacceptable, he began a series of accusations towards Wilde, and even hired private detectives to collect evidence. Oscar Wilde got fed up with his reputation being slandered, accused the Marquess of libel, and takes him to court. When Wilde got a lawyer, his legal team asked him to assure them that the accusations by the Marquess of Queensberry were false, and Wilde confirmed that they were. Bad move. Wilde's friends advised him to quit England and go to France, where this kind of thing was more tolerated, but Oscar Wilde was at the height of his fame. The Importance of Being Earnest was premiering on stage at this time, and it was a hit. For the Marquess to be acquitted of libel, he had to prove that Wilde indeed was engaged in illicit homosexual affairs with young boys, and he did prove it. The libel case was dismissed, the Marquess acquitted, and Wilde was then on the hook for all the legal expenses for the Marquess, which were incurred while fighting Wilde in court, which bankrupted Wilde. From the information gathered in the libel trial of Wilde versus Queensberry, Oscar Wilde was subsequently charged with sodomy and gross indecency and arrested on April 6, 1895. Because Alfred Taylor was older than 13, he was charged alongside of Wilde for gross indecency as well. On May 25th, both were found guilty and sentenced to 2 years of hard labor each. And thus, Wilde's career ended in public shame, and he would never recover. In fact, his health declined, He became an alcoholic and died impoverished and alone on November 30th, 1900 at the age of 46. Now, Wilde had already been expelled from the Masonic fraternity over a decade before his trial that ruined him. There really was no need to act further, except in one instance. When he received the 18th degree, he signed his name in the Golden Book of the Rosecroix chapter. The names are maintained regardless of whether they demit, or suspended, or expelled, unless they are convicted of a felony. The Supreme Council, 33rd degree, would write in a report concerning Wilde's conviction on July 9, 1895, quote, "The erasure from the Golden Book of the name of Oscar Wilde, who has been sentenced to a term of imprisonment with hard labor," end quote. Thusly, the Oxford University Rosecroix Chapter's Golden Book had his name stricken through with a note beside it reading, quote, "Erased, P. Colville Smith, M.W.S., December 5th, 1895. A bit unnecessary, but Sir Philip Colville Smith was known to be puritanically officious. So, should we call Oscar Wilde a brother? No, I don't think so. I'd be ashamed to call him a brother. Some have argued to me, but Patrick, you're a bisexual. Why wouldn't you take his side in the matter? Plus, he was pardoned. Yeah, about that. It's what I call knee-jerk wokeism. He was pardoned under the new Policing and Crime Act of 2017, along with about 50,000 other men previously found guilty of homosexuality. Though homosexuality had already been decriminalized in the UK since 1967. Now, this new act overturned the 1885 Criminal Law Amendment Act that Wilde was originally charged under. Pardoning him of the crime of homosexuality ignores what he was actually being charged with, and ignores what his crimes were. He was guilty of sexual relations with young boys. You know what we call that today? Predatory. Oscar Wilde is what we would call today a sexual predator. I think we get too wrapped up in his fame today and just assume, because he was a Mason at one time, that he must have been a moral person. Never mind that he was despised by nearly everyone everywhere after his trial, especially homosexuals in his day. Many homosexuals believed that Wilde ruined what was a perfectly acceptable thing in Victorian society, and subsequently starting a sort of new witch trials for homosexuals. Bram Stoker, author of Dracula, is believed to have been a homosexual. Maybe. But after the Wilde trials, suddenly he turns homoeroticism into an evil, alluring, dark, twisted, sexy, appalling, monstrous thing. Dracula is a quintessential homoerotic text. And many agree that we can thank Oscar Wilde for Dracula. Across the world, it appears that really only like Walt Whitman remained openly homosexual and no one minded one bit. So, once again, should we call Oscar Wilde a brother? Nope, I don't think we should. I think it's in poor taste. We can acknowledge he was a Freemason at one time, expelled for non-payment of dues, but beyond that, we really should not be trying to imply that he was a good and faithful Mason. He was a predator. His crimes would still be a crime today, and would get him expelled regardless. Don't get me wrong, I love Oscar Wilde's work. He was funny, he's a fantastic narrator, and composes his literature just beautifully. It's exquisite. A fine sense of aesthetics. He was a fascinating individual with a wild biography, but that does not excuse what he did. I don't believe in separating the art from the artist. The life of the artist informs their art. Picture of Dorian Gray is quite the naughty novel. And hardly anyone will deny the crossover between Picture of Dorian Gray and Oscar Wilde's own life. So much so that the text was actually used against him in his trial. But just because you like someone's work does not mean you have to like them. I love the writings of William Burroughs, but it doesn't mean I think he was a good person, not even remotely. He was a junkie all his life, killed his wife, abandoned his children. Yeah, he's not a great guy, but Naked Lunch is the greatest beat novel ever written, hands down. I love the writings of George Bataille, but that dude was messed up. Not sure I'd want to hang out with any of them. So, if you're one of those Masons that loves to say, Brother Oscar Wilde, whenever someone mentions him, maybe don't. It's not a good look. And Wilde knew a thing or two about good looks, so just stop. Don't.
All right, a fantastic piece by worshipful brother Patrick Day. And of course, this is very interesting. Very early on in the WCY podcast, it was part of a video project in which we were putting up images of various Freemasons who had been famous and quotes. And of course, one of them was Brother Oscar Wilde. After this sort of illuminating and thought-provoking piece by Brother Patrick Day, I have to agree with him. There is, of course, no way I would reference anybody to be a brother, famous or not, if they had been convicted of such heinous crimes. And as Brother Patrick Day had suggested, these indeed today would be heinous crimes. Predatory, in the least. I think there are a handful of Freemasons who are famous, who have tainted the fraternity, not necessarily from their actions and people think negatively of Freemasonry, but in the sense that we call them brother, and maybe we really shouldn't. Now, in Oscar Wilde's case, obviously, he was expelled, and he had all these crimes behind him. We would not want such a man to be a Mason today. But there are a number of other Freemasons out there who have made and perpetrated acts which were definitely unbecoming of a Mason in all areas that you could think of. And we tend to just chalk it up to, well, he's still a brother. But should they be? And that's for each and every Mason out there to think about and come to their own conclusions. All right. Now, let's get into part 5 of Manly P. Hall's Occult Embryology. Now this comes, again, as the 5th part in the series. If you're curious on the episodes, we had a little break. So we did Occult Anatomy of Man Part 1, which was episode number 597. Part 2 was 598. Part 3 was 600. So we skipped 599 because we had a great interview with worshipful brother Joe Martinez. And then Part 4 was episode 601. And this is obviously 602, Part 5. The Occult Anatomy of Man, Part 5, Occult Embryology. The great Lord Vishnu has already come 9 times into the world to save his people. His 10th birth is yet to come. His 9 appearances closely paralleled the 9 principal changes taking place in the human embryo previous to birth. Vishnu was born out of the mouth of a fish. He then rose out of the body as a turtle. Still later, he appeared as a boar, then a lion, afterwards a monkey. And after a number of still other changes, he appeared as a man. I noted some time ago that a scientist had arranged a table showing the relationship of the human brain to various animals during the prenatal period. He followed exactly the list of incarnations of Vishnu, who, totally unaware that he was linking together Oriental occultism and Occidental embryology. The cosmogony myths of nearly every nation are based upon embryology. The formation of the cosmos is said to have taken place in the same way that man is formed, only on a larger scale. For example, in the Vishnu Puranas, we are told that creation took place within the womb of men. Space was surrounded by great mountains and cliffs. The universe was created out of water and floated in a great sea, the amniotic fluid. Down the ladder, the umbilical cord, came the gods. 4 rivers flowed into the new land, as told in Genesis. These are the blood vessels of the umbilical cord. So the story goes, and a marvelous correlation exists. Someday, perhaps a new science may be based upon the law of analogy. This will prove to be a far greater contribution to scientific data than all the scientific speculations of all ages. It is reasonably certain that the story of Adam and Eve and the Garden of Eden is based upon embryology, and that the womb is the original Garden of Eden. In symbolism, it is represented by a dot in a circle. This dot is the primitive germ, and so on as far as you wish to carry the analogy. The egg of Brahma is the story of the cosmic embryo, and the embryology is the basic study of creation. In embryology, we also have a very interesting recapitulation of the passage of the human race through the various species of nature. Here we find at certain periods the Hyperborean creatures. At another time, we see the primitive Lemurian man, later the Atlantean, and finally, the Aryan. We most certainly recommend to all occult students that they make a very careful study of this subject. Science knows that all life upon this planet came out of the water. The human embryo is enveloped in water through all the primitive stages of its growth, and in it we find the story of the evolution of all things. Sex did not appear upon the planet until the third race. It does not appear in the embryo until the third month. The recapitulation of the human embryo through the lower kingdoms of nature is one of the strongest proofs of evolution, inasmuch as it proves conclusively that man could not have been made originally in his adult condition. Consequently, he passed through a cosmic embryology. In fact, he is still in the embryo and will not actually be born into the human race until he is truly human, which will not be for many thousands of years. He is just in the state of becoming man. The 9 months of the prenatal epoch have been employed in symbolism for ages. 9 is called the number of man because of the 9 months that the body is in a state of preparation. The perfect number is supposed to be 12, so at the present time, man is born 3 months before he is finished. The gradual unfoldment of the human race will result in more being accomplished during the prenatal epoch, until finally, birth will be the ultimate, and all experience and growth will take place in the embryonic state. Man is not born all at once. We may say that he is born by degrees. The consciousness works outside of the body, laboring with the plastic substances up to the time of the quickening. When it takes hold of the vehicle from within and begins to mold a certain amount of individuality out of the materials which surround it, at the time of birth, the physical body is born, and the process of crystallization sets in, which never ceases for a moment until death. Man begins to die the moment he is born, and the span of life is the length of time which this requires. At the 7th year, the vital body comes into action, and the greatest periods of growth commence. It is then that parents begin to experience difficulties. It is the time of letting clothes down and out. Children shoot up like weeds, for they are literally recapitulating their plant existences, whereas before that time they were recapitulating their mineral state. At about the 7th year, the child begins to manufacture vital essences within their own body. Up to that time, they live upon life forces secreted in the ductless glands of the throat before birth. In other words, they maintain themselves upon life, which they have stored away from the parent. At about 7, they start working for themselves. They are on the go every minute. And if youth could only bottle up its energy and preserve it for old age, what a wonderful world we would live in. Between 12 and 14, in the temperate zones, the liver starts activity. The emotional body is born. It is during these adolescent years that youth faces its greatest problem. Emotionalism runs riot. The consciousness is recapitulating its animal existences. It may truly be said that these are the days of puppy love. These are the years often filled with great mistakes. More lives are blighted between the 14th and 21st years than at any other period of life. It has been observed that the children of strongly emotional races are often brilliant and at the head of their classes until adolescence. When, however, the emotional nature becomes active at about the 14th year, these children frequently lose interest and ability in formal education. Any school teacher who has taught foreign children will vouch for this condition among certain nationalities. The moron is an example of the loss of mental function with the birth of the astral body. And there are many of these examples. During these years of emotional riot, parents must rule their children with firmness and kindness, or those same children will someday turn upon their parents and blame them for ruined lives. Between 18 and 21, according to climatic conditions, the mental body takes hold, and we say that the individual has reached the age of majority, or maturity. He is then permitted to vote. His father presents him with a gold watch and sends him out into the world to seek his fortune. Not one person in a million realizes why 21 is set as the age of majority or maturity, but every occultist knows the reason. The spiritual consciousness, the true I Am, does not take hold of its new body until the 21st year. Up to that time, it is ruled entirely by the lower sense centers. Life thus progresses in cycles of 7 years. As an example of this, we know that the 28th year is the period of second physical birth, the 35th year, the period of second vital birth, or, as it is called, second growth, the 42nd year, the period of second emotional birth. During these years, people otherwise perfectly normal very often grow sentimental. The 49th year marks the dawn of a new period of mental activity, and the following 7 years are the golden years of thought. They are the periods of philosophic reason, the crowning years of life, and so on, cycle after cycle. If the individual waits long enough, he may pass through his second, third, and fourth childhoods. Few people realize that they are composed of mineral, plant, and animal elements. The bones are literally minerals. Hair is a plant nourished by waves of vital ether pouring out through the skin, while within every individual are thousands of little wiggling, creeping, crawling things that make each of us a zoo all by ourselves. The ancient Scandinavians, realizing this, wrote many legends about the little creatures that live in a man. A famous statue of Father Nile shows him covered over with tiny human figures representing the attributes and functions of a man. Man is a great study, but we make very little use of our textbook. The scriptures of all nations are filled with anatomical references to cities and places that have no existence outside of man himself. The 12 gates of the holy city are the 12 apertures in the human body, like the 12 masters of wisdom and the 12 great schools of philosophy. These apertures are divided into two divisions of 7 and 5. There are 7 visible openings and 5 concealed openings in the human body. One of the Greek philosophers told his disciples to remember distinctly that there were 6 openings leading into the human brain, but only one leading out of the human head, and that one led from the stomach. Therefore, they were to listen twice, once with each ear, look twice, once with each eye, sense twice, once with each nostril, but to speak only once, and that, what they spoke, would come from the stomach and the brain. The advice still holds good. The Hebrews used the human head as a favorite symbol to express the divine attributes, calling it the great face. The 2 eyes were correlated to the Father, for they were organs of consciousness. The 2 nostrils to the Son, because they were organs of sense, and also vehicles of prana, the life force in the ether. The mouth was used to symbolize the Holy Spirit, the one who sent forth the spoken word and formed the world. The 7 vowels to which the mouth gave birth were the 7 spirits before the throne, also the vials and trumpets of revelation. They went forth as the army of voice to create in the 7 worlds, and all nature resulted from their creative power. Few realize the magnificent symbolism concealed within the human head, and how it has been used in scriptural writings. That concludes part 5, Occult Embryology. This one was quite interesting in that Hall makes quite a number of correlations to things that maybe most of us might just call coincidental, or a creative way of remembering these things and trying to assign them occult values. Certainly this has been done in Freemasonry for years when people talk about the reason why the apron flaps are up or down, what have you, change with almost every state. In the United States, that is, there's just a lot of this kind of loose talk. However, I find it inspiring and poetic at the same time that it might at least cause us to think a little bit different about our bodies as vehicles for the soul. And also in the ideas that have been put forth in many occult schools that talk about man's incarnation into the physical world, whether that's the fall of man or perhaps a spirit who has lived in the Pleroma and chooses a body or something along those lines, I do feel like this touches on that a bit. So next week, we will get into part 6, which is about occult masonry, perhaps one of the most important chapters of the entire text. It is also the last chapter in the text. I'd love to hear what you have to say over in the Craftsman Plus Facebook group. When we finish the text, I'll put a link to the version that we are reading, as well as I will dump an entire collection of images that I have collected over the years that deal with the idea of the occult anatomy of man. So it should be pretty cool, and then we can look at and discuss all of those things together and have a little brainstorm. Before we close it out, I also wanted to mention ticket sales for MasonicCon Chicago are here, and you can get your tickets right now. So the date, September 16th, 2023, which is just 61 days away at the time of recording, we've got two tickets. One comes with VIP access, which has access to our recordings as well as the swag for the event. We also have a general admission ticket, which is access to the event and all of the speakers. There are no plans to live stream the event. That is by design, but it is not to leave anybody out. It's just the way we did it this year. Our speakers that have been revealed, Mike Jarzabek, past Junior Grand Warden, Chairman of Masonic Education, Grand Lodge of Massachusetts, he's got a brand new presentation that he's been working on. I'm really excited about. Brother Chad Kopensky, past State Education Officer for the Grand Lodge of Ohio, is going to be coming out. We've got Robert William Marshall from Texas. He's a world-renowned historian and storyteller. We've also got Right Worshipful Brother Spencer A. Hammond, who is a District Education Officer here in the 1st Northeast District of Illinois. I've got Darren A. Laners, who is an Area Education Officer and a Toric Award winner, who is coming to speak, as well as the always amazing James E. Fry, who was a District Education Officer and, of course, a Renaissance man. He's like a modern-day Saint Germain. We've got one more speaker to reveal, which will be tomorrow or Tuesday, and we've got a couple of hotels listed on the website. You can get on the mailing list and learn a little bit about what's happening at MasonicCon Chicago. It's sponsored this year by, of course, Space Novum Lodge, number 1183, along with WCY Media and the WCY Podcast. We've got a couple organizations that are going to be in attendance, including the Silas H. Shepherd Lodge of Research, 1843, FNAM, Wisconsin, the only research lodge in Wisconsin, will be there. Also, the Illinois Lodge of Research will be there. We will also have Lakes Chapter de Malay, Job's Daughter International, as well as Three Knocks Apparel from Massachusetts, and a slew of others. I'm hoping to lock in a few extras. I've got one heck of a crazy idea, and if I can lock it in, that we might just have a Friday night pizza event along with a couple of extra speakers on Friday night. Really looking forward to the potential there. We'll see what happens. But the more tickets we sell, the more we can make happen, because every dollar goes right back into the conference, and we're just going to turn around and spend all the money on the participants, the people who come out. So that's it. That again, Space Novum's MasonicCon Chicago, September 16th, 2023. Get on the mailing list. There's going to be lots more emails coming out about speaker topics and all of the things that are going to be happening, including our coin design, the pin design, and much, much more. So again, MasonicConChicago.com. I know there's a lot to do out there Masonically, and we're happy that you'll be able to make MasonicCon Chicago the conference you choose to go to in September. That's it for this week. I want to thank everybody for hanging out, listening to this particular episode. I want to thank our contributors, fellows, producers, legacy partners, those people who make this program happen. If you're curious on how to help the WCY Podcast, head on over to WCYPodcast.com. Click on Support the Show and check out the various options. If you've got anything to share with us, you can certainly send me an email. I get to them eventually. I promise I respond to each and every email personally, and so sometimes it just takes me a little bit. But thanks for anybody out there sharing and doing all of that. So, until next week, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.
That's it. Okay, you're up.